This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary, sitting in for Neil Conan. DJ Danger Mouse is a 26-year-old record producer. One day, inspiration hit him like a lightning bolt while cleaning up his room. In one hand, he held the Beatles' White Album, and in the other, Jay-Z's Black Album. Danger Mouse, a.k.a. Brian Burton, knew he held gold. He blended tracks of the Beatles' music with Jay-Z's rap to create his own Grey Album. For 2.5 weeks, he labored at his computer for just the right sound. And I'm back for more. New York's ambassador. 5 minutes, I'm back to finish my business up. On that track, Burton married the Beatles' As My Guitar Gently Weeps with Jay-Z's What More Can I Say. Thousands of copies of the Grey Album have been distributed online. Problem is, the Beatles' record company EMI Music is working to stop the Grey Album's growth because Brian Burton never had permission to use the White Album. Jay-Z supports Burton's creativity. Lawrence Lessig argues Burton is merely the latest in a long line of creative piracy, artists dipping into other artists' work. The problem is not DJ Danger Mouse, but laws that no longer are in step with the digital media. Join our conversation today. Should the laws be more flexible when it comes to the creativity expressed in the Grey Album? What are your questions about how intellectual property law has adjusted to the digital era? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Lawrence Lessig outlines his thoughts in his new book, Free Culture, How Big Media Uses Technology and the Law to Lock Down Culture and Control Creativity. He's also a law professor at Stanford University, and he joins us now from our New York Bureau. Thanks for being with us.
Really great to be here.
First of all, maybe you can explain, what legal grounds does EMI stand on in this case?
Well, it's a little bit touchy because under federal law, recordings made prior to 1972 are not really protected. So any protection that would exist for the Beatles album that was recorded in 1968 would primarily rely on state law. But the real motivation, the thing that got EMI going, is that here a creator had, without asking permission first, remixed and reused creativity, and their fundamental view is creators have to ask permission before they can build on the past. And that's the key feature of our modern system of regulating copyright that I think is radically different from the way the rule was before.
And you talk about a free culture versus a permission culture, I think. Can you explain what you mean by that?
That's right. I mean, the idea of the word free culture, I think, misleads people. And obviously, I picked the word, so I'm responsible. But I think you need to think about free culture in the way we think about free markets and free society and free elections. These are all systems of balanced control and freedoms. So a free market is obviously not a market where there is no property. Free speech doesn't mean anybody has the right to come into an NPR studio and get on the radio. Instead, those are systems that assure a certain amount of freedom within a system of proper background regulation. And my point is, in the context of culture, we have to try to strike the same balance. The way our tradition has, in my view, quite effectively struck that balance for probably 190 out of the last 213 years. So it's a balance between protection and access. It's a balance between restrictions affected through an important system of regulation called copyright law, and limits on those restrictions that guarantee creators like DJ Danger Mouse to be able to build on the past without, in Oliver Twist-like fashion, needing to beg before the most powerful media companies in the world and ask permission first.
All right, before we talk about what happened in the last 10 years, let's go back 190 years. copyright law was written into our Constitution.
Well, in a very funny way. Our Constitution says that if the states or the government takes away your property, it has to pay you for that. Our framers loved property. But the Constitution grants Congress the power not to issue copyrights, but the power to promote the progress of science, by securing four limited times exclusive rights to authors for their writings. And what that means is if Congress decides to give somebody the property we call a copyright, it must take it away after a limited time. And when it takes it away, it doesn't have to pay anybody for that. Now, this means that the property that we call copyright has from the very beginning been understood to be radically different from the property like your house or your car. Nobody has a fair use right to use your car, but since the early part of the 19th century, there's been a very clear fair use right to build on others' creative work. And no, the government doesn't have the right to come and take your house after a limited time. If it takes your house, it pays for it. But if your copyright expires, then that work passes into the public domain and others get to build on it. That is our tradition. And the framers were very restrictive about copyright. The copyright term of this first copyright statute in the United States in 1790 granted authors a term of 14 years, and if they lived, they could renew it to 28 years, so a maximum of 28 years, but the vast majority never renewed their copyright. So the average term was no more than 15 and a half years. Today, the term is the life of the author plus 70 years, which means for a creator who created in the pattern of Irving Berlin, the term would be 140 years for his most famous work. Now, that's a substantial and radical change, and it's most radically changed in just the last 25 years.
And how did that happen?
Well, Congress in the early, in 1976, fundamentally changed the way copyright law functions in the United States. Before that, in order to get benefit of copyright protection, you had to take affirmative acts. You had to register your copyright. You had to mark your work with that funny little C. You had to deposit your work. You had to renew the copyright after a certain period of time. These were all called formalities, and the formalities were part of a conditional copyright system. The conditional copyright system says, unless you take these steps, you don't get the benefit of copyright. That meant that for published work, a very small proportion was actually regulated by the law of copyright. A vast majority was totally unregulated, and the term of that protection was never in the United States before the 1976 Act more than about 32.2 years in average length. But in 1976, Congress flipped that. They started adopting the European way of protecting copyrights, which means that there are no formalities required. The very moment you scribble a little doodle on your cocktail napkin, it is copyrighted. It's copyrighted whether you mark it or not, whether you register it or not, and it's copyrighted for the full length of the copyright term, which means that even though the vast majority of published or created work has no need for this very expensive system of regulation, all of it is burdened by this very expensive system of regulation. And the consequence of that is that while the average term of copyright in 1976 was no more than about 32 years, the average term of copyright right now is the maximum term, which is almost 100 years. And Congress is in the practice of extending copyright terms as they're about to expire. So we're not even sure what the maximum is anymore.
We're talking about copyright law with Lawrence Lessig. He's the author of Free Culture, How Big Media Uses Technology and the Law to Lock Down Culture and Control Creativity. If you'd like to join the discussion, give us a call at 1-800-989-8255. And we're going to take a call now from Charles in Georgetown, South Carolina. Hi, Charles.
How are you doing today?
I'm very well, thanks.
That's a long-time listener, first-time caller.
Well, go right ahead.
What I'm calling about is really he has stolen somebody else's intellectual property.
And who is he? Who are you referring to?
I guess DJ Danger Mouse would be who I refer to. I mean, basically, I'll put it from another perspective. I make my living by drawing house plans for clients and reselling house plans that we draw. That would be no different from somebody taking one of my house plans, redrawing it, and changing a door or window and calling it theirs. I mean, it's really theft of intellectual property any way you look at it.
Professor Lessing?
Can you hear? Hello.
Yeah, I was asking our guest to respond to your point.
Well, I'm against theft of intellectual property, but we first have to define what the property is. And historically, we've adjusted the definition of what the property is to make it make sense of the technology of the time. Mm-hmm. So everybody knows of Mickey Mouse. Everybody knows that Mickey Mouse was born Steamboat Willie in 1928 in this wonderful little cartoon created by Walt Disney. Most people don't know that in the very same year, Buster Keaton produced a movie called Steamboat Bill Jr., and that Steamboat Willie is this wonderful little takeoff of Steamboat Bill. Now, that takeoff you could describe as theft of intellectual property. But I think that would be a wrong description of it, because I think the law rightly permits creators like Disney, who famously built on other people's works, to build on other people's works in a creative different way. Now, we could argue about whether you think the freedom that DJ Danger Mouse exercised in the Gray Album case should be permitted or not. And I think that's a great argument to have. But I think it's too simple to just say merely because somebody builds on somebody else's work or transforms somebody else's work, they've stolen it. That's never been our practice. And this modern extremism in intellectual property that makes it sound like every time you build on someone else, you're taking from someone else, is totally inconsistent with what our tradition has been.
Well, true. I give an example. Let's say my best-selling house plan. Let's say competition down the street takes my best house plan, changes two doors, and all of a sudden, you know, they go, we put a different front door. Now that's our plan. I mean, that's really, you know, taking money out of my pocket, which, you know, I see it as taking money out. In this case, I was, you know, the Beatles or Jay-Z or whoever the case may be. But what happens when Jay-Z says, you know, he was okay with somebody reusing his album or, you know, doing creativity, if you want to call it that. Now, with that said, what happens when somebody, you know, does it in a slightly different version and makes money off of it and starts taking money out of his pocket?
Good question. Thanks for calling, Charles. I'm going to see if our guest can respond to that second point.
Well, I think it is a great point. But I think the important thing to recognize is, in some cases, it's absolutely right. It would be like taking money out of somebody else's pocket. In other cases, it's absolutely wrong that it's like taking money out of somebody else's pocket. Nobody decides not to buy the White Album or the Black Album because the Gray Album was produced. Instead, the Gray Album, in fact, probably drives demand for the White Album and the Black Album because people want to understand more what the components were that were put into the Gray Album. Unlike your example about your house plan, where you might be right that if somebody just changes one door and then resells it, then they've basically stolen the creativity that you've put into it. But I ask you to ask yourself, in your design of your house, did you begin from the ground up and decide that houses should be two floors and have windows in the front and doors right in the center? Was that your idea? Or did you take that from somebody else? And if you took it from somebody else, did you pay for it? And if you didn't, do you call yourself a criminal too? Because that's the logical conclusion of the extremism of the debate that now dominates, especially in Washington, around intellectual property.
Well, one of the points that you make is that you say that piracy has been a part of creativity. That's the point you seem to be making right now. And on the other hand, piracy is also stealing, isn't it?
That's right. So what I say is, quote, piracy has been a part of creativity, by which I mean at every stage where there's been a new technology that produced a different way to create creative work and to spread it, at every stage, there's been somebody who said that's piracy and somebody else who said, no, it's free ability to build on the past. So there's always been this debate. For example, around the beginning of the last century, there was a technology to make piano rolls. Before that, musicians got paid simply by selling copies of their musical score. Well, then somebody invented the piano roll, and they basically translated a musical score to a piano roll. They started selling piano rolls and selling piano players, and didn't pay the copyright owners of the underlying music a dime. They, in some sense, Napsterized the copyrighted music business. Now, at that time, the industry that supported the musicians claimed this was piracy. And, you know, in some sense, we can understand why they would think that. These people were building on somebody else's work. But that's not what the Supreme Court concluded, and that's not what Congress concluded.
All right, we're going to continue this discussion about intellectual property law when we continue. We'll be taking your calls at 800-989-TALK or send us an email at totn@npr.org. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We've been talking about copyright law, past, present, and future. You're invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We're joined now by Paul Aiken, Executive Director of the Authors Guild. He joins us from his office in Manhattan. Welcome to the show.
Good afternoon.
Now, the Authors Guild represents published writers. You've been listening to our conversation with law professor and author Lawrence Lessig. What's the Authors Guild's position on this? How do you react to Professor Lessig's arguments?
Well, there's much to what Mr. Lessig has said and written that many would agree with, many in our organization would agree with. And much of this has to do with how he views the media conglomerates and major corporations that deal in copyright. But there are hundreds of thousands of small business people, writers and artists, designers, musicians, who need all the protection they can get. We have to make a living in a market economy just like everyone else, and copyright law gives writers and artists a stake in that economy. It says that we're creating marketable goods and that there are enforceable rules protecting our rights in these goods. I understand that he's concerned about what he views as the erosion of the public domain. The Supreme Court has recognized that there's a public benefit to the public domain. But there's a far greater benefit to all of the millions of valuable goods that have been created because of copyright laws, because of the incentives.
Maybe you could explicitly explain how some of Professor Lessing's arguments might pose a danger to writers and their work.
Well, some of it seems to raise issues that aren't even really there. Talking about Steamboat Willie earlier and how Disney apparently built on Steamboat Bill Jr. by Buster Keaton, Disney was free to use that because he was just taking an idea, not the expression. There's an important distinction in copyright law between ideas and expressions. And copyright does not protect ideas. That's the realm of patent laws, and there's a whole different set of rules that apply to that. So anyone is free to, under copyright law, to take an idea and make their own expression out of it. It's where someone takes another's expression and appropriates it for their own use that copyright law has a problem, and this is where writers would have a problem. This is what we create our expressive works, and these need protection if we're to make a living in a market economy.
How long should a copyright stay in the hand of a writer, do you think?
Well, we did not support the copyright term extension to life plus 70 years. Writers are benefit from the copyright laws. We also depend on fair use. We also, biographers and historians and journalists, have to make use of copyrighted works, diaries and letters and memos, in creating new valuable works. It's not in our interest to have copyright extend indefinitely. There, frankly, is conflict among authors as to what the precise length should be, but we did not take a stand supporting extension of copyright to life plus 70 years.
All right, let's take a call now from Danny in Kansas City. Hi, Danny.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I wanted to put a question to Professor Lessig. If he could confirm that the genesis of the movie industry in Hollywood, California, was avoidance of the Edison patents on motion pictures, and if that's true, if people really appreciate the irony and hypocrisy of their current positions.
Okay, thanks for your call, Danny. And I think that is a story that you write about, is it not, Professor?
That's absolutely right. And it's not just the film industry, but it's true that the film industry and Fox, the leader in this, fled the really oppressive burden of the Edison patents on the ability for filmmakers to produce new films by going to a jurisdiction where it was very hard for Edison to enforce his patents. The same thing is true about the birth of the radio industry. The same thing is true about the cable TV industry. These are all industries that, when they're born in this with this charge that they're engaging in a kind of piracy. And what happens is the law eventually catches up and strikes a balance to make sure that this new great form of creativity is not without sense burdened by the law of copyright. Now, you know, I totally agree with the Authors Guild and the importance of copyright, and I am absolutely a believer in copyright. And so everything said about the need of copyright to support incentives, I totally am with. But you know, just because you're for copyright doesn't mean you can't criticize a law that's gone insanely out of control. The Authors Guild was on the right side opposing the extension of copyright. That was the 11th extension of existing copyrights in the last 40 years. And that opposition, I think, was for principled reasons, that the Authors Guild understands that people build on the past by being able to build and take other work and transform it in a way that is creative. But I would disagree that this era is as free as the era that Walt Disney created in to do exactly that. I would not advise a client to go create a Buster Keaton knockoff of Finding Nemo by naming it Finding Nemi and then decide that they can do this merely by fair use. That would be a very dangerous strategy in today's market.
Paul Aiken, let me just turn to Paul Aiken for a moment again, because I know Paul Aiken of the Authors Guild, I wanted you to address Professor Lessing's argument that current copyright laws stifle creativity.
No, I don't think so at all. The example earlier of the floor plan had to do with ideas, not expression. Again, and once you make the proper distinction between what's an idea and what's an expression, this problem largely melts away. Now there have been
melts away. Can I just suggest it melts away for people
who
deal with
text? Let me finish. There are examples of people abusing their rights. There are. If someone may bring a lawsuit where someone has parodied another work, The Wind Done Gone is an example of that, the author has to fall back on fair use laws to say this should be permitted. But this happens in all sorts of complex areas of society and the economy where there are legal fights over whose rights should prevail.
All right, we're going to take a call now from Jane in Murray, Kentucky. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Thanks for having me on. I had a story of mine, which was in a book published by Harcourt for ESOL students. It was pirated by a Japanese educational company, and I found out about it when I was tutoring two little girls and reading them a story from this book which had gone out of print, and they recognized it. Peter's the Orange Man. They knew it very well, and it's in this book, and I haven't been able to find out the name of the publisher, but I've seen a copy of it from this Japanese book, and if you go to the Internet and type Pete and the Orange Man, my story comes up on the screen, and a lot of Japanese, which I don't read.
And so your question, I'm sorry, your question.
My question is there any way that an author can pursue this on their own? It's small potatoes to Harcourt, and this book is out of print.
Paul Aiken, do you have any?
This is on a Japanese website.
It's evidently a Japanese website, but it comes up. When you type in Pete and the Orange Men, my story comes up.
Okay, if it's on a U.S.-based website, there's something called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which would allow the rights holder to have that work taken down, and so there's something that definitely could be done. Under Japanese law, that would be something we'd have to research to see what could be done.
All right, thanks so much for your call, Jane. And Paul Aiken, thank you also for joining us today.
Thank you.
Paul Aiken is the executive director of the Authors Guild, and he joined us from his office in Manhattan. Lawrence Lessing is still with us from our New York Bureau. His latest book is How Big Media Uses Technology and the Law to Lock Down Culture, called Free Culture, How the Big Media Uses Technology and the Law to Lock Down Culture and Control Creativity. I wanted to turn now, Lawrence Lessig, to a law case that you were very much involved with. You argued before the Supreme Court the case of Eldred versus Ashcroft, which had in part to do with the use of Robert Frost's writings. I wonder if you can just tell us about the case and what happened with it.
Yeah, so I lost the case before the Supreme Court, challenging the Copyright Term Extension Act. And our basic claim was, if the Constitution means anything by saying copyright terms are to be for a, quote, limited time, then it must mean that Congress can't be free every time copyrights are about to expire to extend the terms of copyright. And we brought that case on behalf of a web publisher, Eric Eldred, who had a free public library that he put up on the web of works that were in the public domain. And he intended to put up a bunch of works by Robert Frost, but then the latest Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act extended the term of copyrights by 20 years, and so he can't put that up until 2019. The Supreme Court's response was, well, you know, Congress has been doing this for a long time, and we're not going to step in and mix things up now. And I think part of the reason the Supreme Court did that is the same reason Paul Akin is so satisfied with the way the existing system works. And that's because when you think about text, the restrictions of copyright law don't seem terribly burdensome, although I'd argue they are, but I agree. We've got a long tradition protecting the freedoms of text. And that's in part protected by what Paul describes as the idea-expression distinction. You can re-express an idea, you just can't take somebody's expression. But that sort of formalism that lawyers talk about makes no sense when you start talking about the multimedia that exists in the context of the internet. What is the idea embedded in the White Album by the Beatles? What's the distinction between the idea expression? Or what's the idea in a picture that's distinct from the particular expression? You know, this is a great way to talk about how texts work. But my point is, in a context where we've got this extraordinary creative potential of being able to, of anybody being able to mix together sounds and images and words and put them out in an expression that is far more powerful than any single text could be, we should be updating the law to make that freedom as free as it is with respect to text. If I sit down and write an editorial about Walt Disney Corporation, there's nothing the Walt Disney Corporation can do. They can't stop me. I don't have to ask permission. I can quote them at length, and the law protects that very effectively. But if I put up a website about the Walt Disney Corporation, the very same act that Paul was invoking, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, would make it very hard for me to express in the most powerful way this very same ideas using that medium. And my only point is, that freedom that we have with text needs to be brought into the 21st century so that the extraordinary creativity of kids to use this technology to be and express something different should not be stifled by laws first written in the 17th century.
Okay, let's take a call now from Carol in Gilbert, Arizona. Hi, Carol.
Hi, this is Charles. My question, it goes back to the Beatles album versus someone having an architectural drawing for a house. If there is some kind of difference, a line that's to be drawn between art forms and music as such, and things that could be used for commercial use, like, I mean, with the issue where DJ Danger Mouse using the White Album and Jay-Z's Black Album to come up with its own version of the Gray Album, can be equated to someone putting Forrest Gump sitting next to John Lennon asking questions.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great analogy, and the problem, of course, is that if you tried to do that, you would face serious risk, at least if you published it in the context like the internet, even if it's for non-commercial purposes. I mean, many of the stories that I tell in my book are cases where people are engaging activity that's totally for non-commercial purposes, yet the burden of the law makes it impossible for them to do that legally, so that we basically have rendered a huge extent of creativity illegal because we've not allowed these laws to come up to date with the new technology. And so the law has lots of distinctions that were built in assuming the technologies of the 19th century. So the difference between performing music publicly or producing a record or producing a book or producing a movie. But none of those laws were written in a way that took into account a technology where anybody can just go out onto the net and mix and remix culture in a way that expresses it much more powerfully, but without being able to hire a gaggle of lawyers to go clear the permissions necessary to do it. And our system has made it extremely hard for people to create legally. And so many people don't create legally, they create illegally, and that's the view of many lawyers about DJ Danger Mouse. And many people don't create because they don't want to be illegal in what they're doing. But my only point is, why should the law be getting in the way when there's no good showing that it's doing good? Now, again, that doesn't mean abolish copyright law. I'm for copyright law. But just make the law rational for the technology. When you have companies, organizations like the RIAA going out and suing 12-year-olds, and you've got an extraordinary burden being imposed on networks because of this policing of content, I don't think the law yet has attained the status of rational.
We're talking about copyright law, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're going to take another caller now from Bob, or is it Rob, in Montrose, Colorado. Hi, Rob.
Hi. My comment is that enforcement of trademarks and copyright should also be rationalized. Business people, CEOs of big companies, ought to educate their lawyers that aggressive intellectual property enforcement doesn't always serve the higher purpose of the corporation. Case in point, embroiderers and screen printers are being harassed by General Motors and other large companies who are actively pursuing these little guys for printing and embroidering the pictures of old General Motors vehicles on jackets for car clubs. And what they're doing by this enforcement is upsetting a large constituency of potential customers.
Yeah, this is one example of a million. I get them all sent to me, I think, and it's extraordinary. And some of it is because the law forces the corporations to enforce it vigorously. And some of it is because lawyers just don't think about the business consequences. So my favorite example is the Sony Aibo dog. There were a bunch of fan sites set up to make it so that the Sony Aibo dog, this little robot dog, could be taught to do different tricks. And so one site taught people how to teach their Aibo dog to dance jazz. And, you know, I mean, we should remember, it's not a crime to dance jazz in the United States. It's not even a crime to teach your dog to dance jazz in the United States. And they're taking dogs that they've purchased, and they're just making it so the dog can dance jazz differently. Well, a middle management lawyer from Sony fired off a letter to this website threatening legal action because they're violating the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which makes it a crime to tinker with copyrighted protection systems, even if your purpose is totally legal. Now, it took Sony management about 2 weeks to recognize that this was insane, because if you could teach your dog to dance jazz, the dog's more valuable, so Sony would be better off by making it easier for people to value the stuff that they're selling. So quickly, they withdrew the threat. But the point is, the law often doesn't think about the business reality, and businesses have got to stop turning their future over to lawyers, whose focus is on the past and on this extraordinarily complex set of regulations, which I believe doesn't make sense for the future.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Lawrence Lessig's latest book is Free Culture, How Big Media Uses Technology and the Law to Lock Down Culture and Control Creativity. He's also a law professor at Stanford University. When we come back from a short break, as if he didn't own enough, Donald Trump is trying to trademark the phrase, "You're fired." We'll talk about how one person can lay claim to the phrases we all use, and we issue an email challenge. What phrase would you trademark if you could, and why? I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.